And I plead poetic license because the person who is here to verify it, the person who could verify it, is here in this room. So if I got anything wrong, that's okay because I'm telling a story, all right? So there I was teeing off on the 10th hole of Bear Creek Country Club. You know where I'm going with this? You know already. Okay, so it's a 400-yard hole. There's a dog leg to the left. Hit the ball far over the junk on the left, straight enough, far enough, and you can cut the distance by 40 yards. And the biggest hitters could even hit the green. I've never seen anyone do it, though I have come close a time or two. And having just come out of the lunchroom, we had our sandwiches and our Snickers bars, and I am stoked. I'm thinking to myself, come on now, you can do it. Time for a better back nine. So I'm readying myself to go for it yet again, knowing full well that almost every time I try and cut that dog leg, I end up losing a ball and get a two-stroke penalty. So suddenly, I look on the tee box. They let some foursome go off in front of me and Dad, a twosome. Not cool. Now all I can think about is how long before those bozos will let us play through. Just then I see this athletic-looking guy, almost shining, maybe Swedish or something. He stands tall and he addresses his ball, and with effortless ease of someone like a professional hockey player or something who swings sticks for a living, he takes his club back oh so smoothly. Great transition, I'm thinking. Swoosh, swoosh, crack. Who is this guy? The dude cuts the dog leg 360 plus yards right next to the green. Maybe on it, because you can't tell from the tee box. But I don't care. Dad, do you know who that is? Who? He asked, munching on some chips. That's my hero. That's my cousin. Dad, that's Peter Forsberg. My great-grandfather, you see, was a Forsberg from Sweden. And we had wondered many times if we might not be related to Herr Peter. And that's not German, that's Swedish, okay? Who just happens to be the fourth all-time assist per game and eighth all-time points per game leader in the history of the NHL, by the way. And largely responsible for bringing Colorado its first national champion of any significance in any team sport. This is Peter Forsberg. I bet we can play through them, I tell Dad. We can find out, and then we can find out if he's related to us. Now, where's Grandpa Forsberg from again, I ask? Dalarna, I think it's Dalarna, he said. Okay, I'll ask him. So there we sit in our cart following pretty much my all-time hero around the course for several holes, and then we come to this perilous little 13th, a short 160-yard par 3 lofted high over the water, behind which is tucked the narrowest but widest green you have ever seen in your life. It's 120 feet long, only 30 feet deep. Good luck even hitting it. They whistle us to play through. Now is my shining moment, my 15 seconds of fame, my chance to prove to someone special that I'm a somebody. I stand nervously over the ball with my 8-iron in hand. I waggle once, I waggle twice. The sweat is dripping off my hands and my face. I wipe them off. I waggle again. I waggle again. Just swing the dumb club already. I'm scolded by my father, who's rolling his eyes at me. Swoosh, swoosh. Chunk, right into the water with Peter Forsberg looking on. Swell, real swell, idiot. I'm mumbling to myself, oh well, take out another ball and nonchalantly knock it on the green 35 feet from the hole. I promise you I am not going to double bogey this hole, Dad. I'm making that putt. More eye rolling at me. We get to the green and I introduce myself and say some couple of dumb things, fumbling over my words in front of my hero, but managing to ask him if he's from Dalarna. I'm pretty sure we're related, I wink at old Pete, not my dad this time. Actually, we've been wondering if it's possible, I tell him, because, see, my great-grandfather is a Forsberg. You are something of a regular item of conversation in our house, I tell him, and not just because you're the toughest, most athletic, total stud hockey player we've ever seen. More eye-rolling from my dad. No, he says, I'm farther north from Ornskoldsvik, he tells me. I doubt if we have relatives in Dalarna. I said, I'm pretty sure that you do. You look like some of my relatives. I put my foot in my mouth once more, like an idiot, just make the dumb putt and redeem yourself even a little bit, please. So these are the moments when boys become men. I stand over the ball for the 20-something time today. I haven't made a single putt. I couldn't buy a putt. 35 feet. This baby's going in. Smooth stroke now. Tap. The ball starts rolling faster and faster down the hill of a lightning-fast green after a 5-foot break to the right. And you know how it ends, right? You know how my story ends? Clink, right into the bottom of the cup. I didn't double bogey. I Chichi Rodriguez my putter with his pattern Zorro action fancy footwork all the way to the hole. I look right in the eyes of Peter Forsberg and I say, "Yeah, I saved the bogey." The point is, to quote R. Kent Hughes, the presence of notable witnesses is motivating, whatever one's activity may happen to be. All the more when it happens to be your favorite athlete in the world. Beloved, how much more even than that, with this great cloud of witnesses that we are seated next to, who surround us and testify to us on our pilgrimage to the heavenly city. Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Joshua, Daniel. Let's turn to Hebrews 12, 1 through 3 and see what I'm talking about, all right? Now, these three little verses have received more than their fair share of attention over the years, and that includes as topics of sermons and of study. So I want us to try and understand why they're here first. And the way I want to do this is by getting you to think about worship. Worship is something that most people, I fear, think of as being done only in church. But that's only the beginning of worship. That's where God's people gather to worship. But what about after we leave our gathering together? So Hebrews 12 is the main transition of the entire book. It really marks the end of the apostle's exposition of the Old Testament and the beginning of his application. And of course, there's parts of each of those in the other sections as well. But for the generally speaking, that's what's going on here. And in many respects, it reminds me of the book of Romans, except that Romans is not a biblical theology like Hebrews. It's doing something else. So in Romans, the first 11 chapters, the apostle is dwelling into systematic themes like total depravity or the role of the law or divine sovereignty and predestination, perseverance, evangelism, the role of Israel in God's redemptive plan, and so on. And after that whole lengthy treatment in the longest part of the book, he ends with a doxology of worship. And this is what he says. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. If theology, this is what I think he's saying, if theology is just a head trip for you and it does not lead you to worship a God who at the end of the day is incomprehensible and as far above our knowledge as the heavens are above the earth, then you're either not studying the God of the Bible or you don't know him. Immediately after this, Romans begins its application and it likewise deals with worship. So this is Romans 12:1. Curious that we're in Hebrews 12:1 as well. It's a good way to remember the transitions. He says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. And he's not talking about worship necessarily in church. Rather, it's all the time. And how, he goes on, he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that by testing you may discern what the will of God is, that is the good and acceptable and perfect will. So Hebrews 11, the first 11 chapters, of course, is a different focus than Romans 1 through 11. We've been talking about the supremacy of Christ above all things. He's greater than angels, greater than Moses, greater than Aaron, greater than the law, greater than Old Testament sacrifices, greater than the older covenants. Jesus is superior to all things. Chapter 11 has been told us of the saints of old and that they knew this and that they were looking forward to it by faith. But Hebrews 12, 1 through 3, our passage, is very similar in purpose to Romans 12, 1 through 2, even though its language is very different. Now, they both begin with a therefore, connecting it to what's come before. In Hebrews, it's as if he's saying, because of all that you have now heard, and in light of these things, with those thoughts squarely in your mind, and especially the thoughts of Hebrews 11 and the faith of the saints, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Now this verse, verse 1, and the next verse make up two of the most well-known verses in Hebrews, and maybe even in the entire New Testament. Why? Okay, I want to give you two reasons why they're so well-known. The first is content, and the second is construction. So let's deal with construction. Some say that the first verse shows signs of being an ancient hymn fragment, like they could have been singing this. It has style and syntax and strophes and form and arrangement. And most of all, it has the basic Christological content that we find in other likely biblical hymn fragments like Philippians 2 and Colossians 1 and 1 Timothy 3:16. So it could be called a song of King Jesus. Now, the first two verses together make this memorable chiasm where they repeat at the beginning and end, and they come in, and there's a center part, which is keep your eyes on Jesus, the perfecter of your faith. Now, why would we even care about the form of the text? Well, there's two reasons. One is that style matters to God, and we've seen this time and again in Hebrews. As someone has said, to the biblical authors, artistry in the use of structure is not an end to itself. It was a means toward a more effective communication of their messages. In this case, it makes it memorable so that it's easier to keep in your mind. And in some ways, it's just like worship, because God cares about form. God cares about how we worship Him. And these two verses are definitely meant to lead us to worship with our bodies. Now, second, this chiasm can help us understand the central point, the focus of the verses. Now, this focus is different from what a lot of people are told when they come to Hebrews 12. They'll say something like, look at their faith, be like them, and that's what we're supposed to get out of this. Now, I do want to say those two little sentences, look at their faith, be like them. Those are important, but if they're left by themselves, which they often are, then the results can be deadly. Professor Baugh over at Westminster says, note that our author does not call the Old Testament believers of Hebrews 11 examples for us to emulate. Though that may be a secondary implication of our text. Rather, they are first and foremost witnesses who testify to the reality of the heavenly verities which God has promised to them and to us. Not examples, but people who testify. See, through the faith of the heroes of the Hall of Faith, even though they're there begging you to kind of emulate their faith, without the power to do so, it's nothing less than man-made legalistic works righteousness to say, I want to be like them, if that's all it is. Even we can turn faith into a work. It's just crazy what we humans can do. So the way verse 1 is often understood, and in part translated even, can add to this if we're not careful. So there seems to be a metaphor in verse 1, and it seems to be that of a race. And thus it is common to see commentators assume that what is in mind is something like this. And they'll use like an Olympic analogy. Hebrews takes a track and field metaphor and kind of thought about the athletic thing with Peter Forsberg was in my mind when I was thinking about this. They'll use an athletic metaphor to motivate readers to rid themselves of sin and to run the race and regard Jesus and reflect upon the faith of the saints. They say, we are to imagine a huge stadium like the Roman Colosseum. And so it's filled with people, and this is the cloud of witnesses. Someone actually writes, they are crowded, as it were, row upon row within the encircling amphitheater. So that's what we're supposed to imagine. And the analogy as it goes next then relates to how the runners ran in those days. And this, I think, is important to understand. Unlike modern times, the Greeks were completely uninhibited in their sports. They would strip naked before competing. And thus, lay aside every weight is supposed to be the analogy of that. We're supposed to strip ourselves bare of sins and entanglements. And so this is a marathon now, so we have to run for a long time before we finally win the prize. And so endurance is more important than sprinting. You try and sprint in this race and you will likely tire very quickly and maybe even give up. All right, so that's kind of what we've all been taught. And it all sounds great. And in places, and this is important, it's even a biblical metaphor to run the race. I'm not saying it's not. But something seems amiss with the totality of what people seem to think this is saying. So I want you to ask yourself, why would somebody writing to a bunch of Jewish Christians, probably former priests, and I could go into a whole set of Old Testament reasons to think that this is a big problem, it would be a problem for these guys. Why would they write something that would almost certainly offend them with the implied nudity? So scholars have started asking just that question, and they're opting for a different metaphor, translating the words in a different way. So rather than run, it can mean also to strive or to press onward. Okay? And rather than race, it can also mean an intense struggle against strong opposition. Now, those aren't necessarily the same things. It can mean mortal peril. And clearly, in the previous chapter, it's not a race that's in mind, but it is certainly overcoming peril and danger and death. And so the metaphor here may not be that of a race, but rather that of a pilgrimage. John Bunyan would be pleased to hear that. The setting is not a Colosseum, but it's life itself. And it's not a race, but a constant struggle to move forward to get to heaven itself. In other words, it's exactly what you would expect having just finished Hebrews 11. Now, as we try to get ourselves into this proper context, the word witnesses becomes very important to understand. The cloud of witnesses. This word never refers to onlookers, especially people who are just coming to watch a sporting event. This can give us the completely wrong impression of what the witnesses are actually here doing. They are not cheerleaders sitting on the sidelines offering up dance moves and catchy chants to keep us motivated. It's not their purpose. Like witnesses in a court, like Abel's blood, these people are living witnesses in heaven of the faith that it takes to finish and of the person in whom faith must be placed in order to even begin the journey home. They are the great cloud, a picture used in the Old Testament for glory, the Shekinah, for heaven. And it's a phrase used in the Greek poets for a huge throng of people. The people who are here in this cloud may not be athletically gifted like Peter Forsberg, who is such an inspiration to me. No, they are much greater because their witness is not about sports. It's about salvation. These are people who are both instantly recognizable and sometimes completely obscure. These are famous and unknown. Moses is testifying. Moses, Abraham is speaking. And so also are the two poor widows who had their sons raised from the dead, even though they don't even have a name in the Bible. These people surround us, it says. They go before us. They encourage us. And most of all, they testify to us as witnesses that what we are trying to do right now in our lives and in our worship is not in vain, and that it can be done if our eyes are fixed on the right object. So there's four things that we're told to do in these verses. I'll give you four R's to write down. And it's not reading, writing, and arithmetic, okay? And something else. It's rid and run and regard and reflect. Rid, run, regard, and reflect. So he moves from right thinking in the first 11 chapters to now right behavior. Now that your mind has been set firmly where it should, now that your thinking is proper, now that you understand the relationship of the present age of Christ to the fading shadows of the Old Testament, now that you've been granted faith and know what it is, it's time to do something about it. So the first is that we are to lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Probably spend most of the time on this one. Someone has called this divesting yourself. I call it ridding yourself. Of what? What are we to rid ourselves of? Sin. But in order to understand the command, we have to understand the problem. So what in the world is sin? Well, you could go on the streets of almost anywhere in this country right now, and they couldn't tell you in a million years what sin is. That question could take up several sermons. But basically, sin is when you deviate from God's revealed will and desire for your life, especially in His law. Sin makes no sense apart from God. And this is the reason why our secularized culture no longer even takes it seriously. They don't believe in God. They couldn't care less about Him. So sin has no meaning for them. If you can't sin, or you can't sin if there's no one to sin against, you see. But we know better. We're Christians. And frankly, they know better because they have a conscience. The meaning of sin is vast and it's hard to summarize because there's actually, I didn't know this, there's over 50 words in Hebrew that describe sin. The three most popular, I think, help us to think about what sin is. One word is the word chata, and it means something like being mistaken or found deficient or at fault, thereby missing the mark. You've heard this before. It's used of archery in the book of Judges when somebody can't hit his target. Or like many men who refuse to ask for directions, they're missing the road in Proverbs 9, okay, or 19. Like me, if you move and you lose, if you're someone who takes something, you can miss your property. I can't tell you how many things I haven't been able to find in the past 4 months. You're missing something, okay? In Proverbs, wisdom. You can be missing wisdom. That's all the same word. So it's being mistaken or deficient or at fault or missing something. Second word is pasha, and it is willful, deliberate violation of a norm or a standard. So the idea of this word is the idea of rebellion or revolt. A breach of covenant and the alliance with whom you have a fellow king in the Old Testament. As the law is the terms of the covenant God makes with man and then Israel and even us, that word fits very well for breaking the law. It's deliberate violation of God's law. The third word is avon, and it means something like an error or iniquity. And this is a deeply religious meaning, profoundly immoral, and always refers to iniquity before God. This is the idea of sin and guilt and punishment. Put these things together and you start to get a picture for how serious sin is and exactly what it is. Another way to help you think about this is the way that sin is sometimes personified in the Bible. In Genesis 4, it's actually likened to a demon who lies in wait, crouching to pounce on an unsuspecting person. In Romans 6 and 7, it's likened to a slave master who owns you until you're freed by Christ. And then it's likened to a spouse that you are wed to until the spouse dies, which frees you from your vows to it. We're not to let sin reign over us anymore. Just like our founding fathers would not let a tyrannical king rule over them. So it's likened to a king in your life. In James 1, sin is like a pregnant woman. It can actually give birth. And when it gives birth to a baby called death. In Hebrews now, when we come to this verse, sin is likened to a terrible, dangerous trap. Something like the NAS has sin entangling us. You can think of walking through a dense jungle and getting all tangled up in the suffocating undergrowth and the vines. Or maybe a carnivorous plant, like the beautiful sundew plants, if you've ever seen these things. They really are very pretty things. They have these little kind of spiky things on the end of them, and they have sweet nectar that lures the fly in. Once he lands, three sticky little hairs bend over just his wings, just kind of keep him there. He doesn't even realize it, but he can't leave now. But he doesn't care because he's too busy eating the nectar. But soon, when he tries to fly away, he finds that he can't. And so he struggles. And the harder he struggles, the more hairs start bending over on top of him until he's completely and utterly trapped. And within 2 hours, he's been sucked dry of all of his life. He's just a skeleton now, easily discarded for the next unsuspecting little creature. Proverbs uses the metaphor of a prostitute on the streets who entices you with flattering words, promising you a night of pleasure for little more than a handful of change. But she is death itself, and those who go to her find themselves going down to the grave. Bob Dylan sang about exactly this when he was singing Tangled Up in Blue. The ESV has it as something like clings closely, and it's a heavy weight. Kind of like Christian's burden in Pilgrim's Progress, where he has to carry this burden on his journey to the celestial city. Severian of Gabala, I had never heard of this guy, but he's in the Ancient Christian Commentary series. He wrote, "Let us lay aside every weight. Weight is sin of the enjoyment of the flesh, a form in which the sin which clings so closely is born. It clings closely to us as it surrounds us with pleasure and subdues us by its will." So many ways of picturing sin. But do you get the point? So sin is something that you must be utterly suspicious of, on your guard against, vigilant in fighting. Now, what you're ultimately fighting against is something that is inside of you and something that in your flesh you desperately love doing. Do you know that? Why do we sin? Because we like to sin. There's no other reason for it. It clings closely because it is inside of us and we are attracted to it, just like that fly, just like that man who hears the call of the siren and goes out to her at night. And in this way, it surrounds us, it entangles us, it pulls us down. Sin is the chief danger of the Christian, really of all people, because sin is what brings us to hell. Sin never does anyone any good. No sin, no matter what it is, ever does anyone good. You say, well, sure, maybe it does. It gives temporary pleasures. It gives some people power. Maybe riches. Maybe chemical highs, maybe fleshly euphoria. You can gain status. You can have power. You can get fame. All those can come from sin. But you know what? Every single one of those fade away. Time is the great leveler of us all. And in their wake comes ruin and misery, destruction, broken relationships, ended friendships, ruined lives, destroyed churches, fines. You can go to prison. There can be wars caused by sin. Hell is the ultimate doom. And you know what? In light of what happened this week, even the Clintons won't be able to escape its clutches at the end of the day. It doesn't matter who you are. You will not escape your sin. Sin surrounds us all. But we're also surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. And these witnesses were sinners, just like Isaac Watts penned in our song this morning, just like you and I. But they journeyed on and they made it to the end because of faith. God preserved them and brought them home. And these witnesses are here, even this very moment. They are speaking to you, not from the other side, but from this side, by their lives and trials and deaths. They're telling you to lay down the weight of sin. R.E. Bartlett wrote, "He summons them one by one as witnesses of the unseen power which attained them, to testify to us that as they ran, so can we. As they overcame, so can we overcome. They're not here and there, but they encompass us about on every side. They're not one or two, but they are a cloud." Here's how Herodotus spoke about a cloud, the cloud of witnesses. He uses the same phrase. Herodotus is that Greek historian. He says, "Wherefore I say to you, as it is to a fortunate chance that we ourselves in Hellas and have driven away so mighty a cloud of enemies, let us not pursue after men that flee." That's how many friendly witnesses we have. It is a cloud of them. But as we saw, sin is a heavy burden. It is something that when you engage in it and engage in it more, it becomes consuming to you. It's all you can think about. You obsess upon your sin. It destroys your mind. It ruins your thoughts. It forces your body to do things against its will. Like a weightlifter who is in over his head because he's putting too much weight up, he comes crashing down and the body is helpless against the free fall of the weights. Perhaps the scariest thing about this is that he's talking about sins that each of us is prone to individually. So I may be tempted to by something that in a million years you wouldn't even consider, but also vice versa. This is what the King James calls besetting sin in this passage. So these are sins that entangle you personally, and you know what your sins are. Our culture's in the throes of sexual sin, but not everyone. Churches have been utterly destroyed by gossip, but not everyone gossips. Some are tempted by pride, started thinking about how when you're not prone to one particular sin, how easy it is for you to pick on that sin. That's a pride that's welling up in your heart, and it's a sin for you. Some people have doctrinal righteousness, which replaces the righteousness of Christ. Some want to look good in front of others. Some are consumed with always having to be perfect people, putting these things on themselves that nobody else puts on themselves. And they're consumed by it. It's a sin. Some people are consumed with rage and hate. Some are utterly discontent in their life and they complain about almost every sentence that they speak. Some can't consume even good things in life because they're addictive and destructive for them. Friend, what are the sins that beset you? And if you can't think of one, start right there. I can't blast on one sin when all sin is the problem. I can't single out one of you when we all need to be singled out and woken up. When they do come to you and seek to entangle you, are you prepared to put them down? Now the question becomes, how do you do that? It's a vital question. Maybe you never have. Maybe you love your sin and you think, I'm crazy. Why would I want to give that up? Maybe you're greatly burdened by your own besetting sins. Do you see those in the clouds speaking to you now? What are they saying to you? They're saying that you can't just will faith and the ability to put it down sin into existence. This is not mind over matter. This is not a 12-step program. Look at what is in opposition to ridding yourself of sin's hindrances. What comes after that? And let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. So running, or as I said earlier, striving or struggling to press on. Where are we doing this? We're doing this in what Jerome calls the Valley of Tears. So this running is the second thing you're called to do. He said, this place then, a valley of tears, is not a condition of peace, not a state of security, but it's an arena of struggle and endurance. Let's get back on the trail and keep on walking ahead towards the goal. If you've ever gone backpacking, we live in Colorado, so we can use that analogy all the time. You know that those packs can be heavy. If you're like me, you don't just pack the pack. I don't know why people do that. Let's go backpacking. No, I want to go somewhere, okay? To me, it's not just about the journey, especially not with a big old heavy backpack on my back, wandering around aimlessly, just a pack. I'm going to the promised land, okay? So you set off and you're going somewhere, like maybe to the top of Mount Everest. I'm not one for just walking on long trails. I like going up, but it can be dangerous. You have to take things with you. You have baggage. Some of that baggage you take is necessary, but there's a lot of unnecessary things, tempting things that we can take. The sin, this is what is so dangerous. Came to my mind this story. I remember one time hiking with this young man who had never gone up a mountain before. So he takes his pack with him and he packed and he packed and he packed. He had a whole gallon of water. I didn't even know this was in his pack. He had a 20-pound video camera because he was going to capture the entire thing. So this wasn't in modern days, obviously. This was a while ago. I think he might have even brought a solar-powered refrigerator with him. I don't know. All for a three-hour hike. It was like going to Gilligan's Island or something, right? Have you ever wondered why they brought all that stuff for a three-hour tour? It's like the whole boat is full of sin. Think about it that way. Okay? On the trail, this guy quickly fell behind, and at some point he basically just stopped. But he got to a point where he was really high, and he was off trail, and he was on this dangerous ridge. And he stopped in a pretty place, but he was no longer moving because he was stopped. He wasn't going to the goal. And that's the idea in mind here. You have to keep moving. When you sin, you aren't moving. You aren't on the journey. You aren't running any longer. Moving is the opposite of sinning. Do something. Okay? There's a thing at the very end of the sermon. I didn't know where to put it in. It just hits me. It's a letter that David Brainerd wrote to Jonathan Edwards. And he says, you know, I'm convinced that the best way to get rid of sin is to keep yourself from being idle all the time. Keep moving. Run the race. If you stop too long, you might just decide that those are very pretty sights. And you might be content with just that. Especially if you see the weather moving in. I don't want to go up any higher. You might even forget why you took off on this long journey in the first place. One commentator writes, "The danger lies in sin's ability to distract the pilgrim from his pilgrimage. Sin's distractions can be to such an extent that the pilgrim fails to reach his destination." And he says, note the hostile sense in which the sin entangles the actor. This is why Pilgrim's Progress became one of the top 5 selling books of all time, because it so vividly captures all of this. You must endure to the end by always moving forward. You see what your besetting is, then start moving. Stop going to the sin and start doing something different. Have faith in Christ and look towards that. It easily entangles you. Let's think about where we're going. We're not going to Mount Everest, but we are going to a celestial mountain, the mountain of God. We're heading to heaven. It's even more defined than that, than just a mountain. We're heading to Jesus, you guys. He's the part that so often gets passed over when people think about this passage. I can't for the life of me figure out why that is. Go back to my friend on the mountain. His weight was just way too heavy for this little fellow. Though he had no idea ahead of time that that would be the case, he became tired and disoriented. And if he didn't have his buddy there to carry all that weight for him that he was not prepared to carry, I don't know what would have happened to him. He got himself into a dangerous situation because the weight was too much to bear. And he'll admit exactly what I'm telling you if you go and ask him about it. And I thank God for his friend who never left his side, because I was walking off on ahead with other people. This is where the center of the chiasm and the true point of Hebrews 11 and the beginning of 12 here converge. This is the third thing we're told to do, looking to Jesus. Let's start at verse 2. It's the main point of the text. He's our destination. He's what our eyes are fixed on, but he's so much more. He's our helper. He's our destination. He's the reason we travel. He's our beginning. He's our end in so many ways. So we're to regard him, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. Let's think about this idea of a founder for a moment. This is a great little verse. I love this. He's a founder in two senses. The first one is, many do not understand this. He gives us our faith. Do you know that? Founder refers to its origin. Notice that faith is not something you create. It's a gift of God in Ephesians 2:8. So many people tell others, if you'll just believe with your own free will, you'll be saved. And I respond, yes, you must believe, and yes, it must be freely, and it will be when God regenerates you, but you can't create this in yourself any more than a dead man can create life in himself. But through the speaking of the gospel, by the power of the Spirit, the Word of God creates faith. And it strengthens faith. It's one of the reasons we come to church. It's one of the reasons why we even bring unbelievers here. It's why we tell people the gospel. This is such good news, because it means that if he puts faith here, he means to do something with it. The second way he's the founder of our faith has to do with faith's ultimate embodiment. I wonder if you've thought about this. This isn't in Abel. He doesn't ultimately embody faith. Not Enoch, Noah, not Abraham, not Moses, not Daniel, not Joseph. Take a pick. The ultimate embodiment of faith is the Lord Jesus himself. R. Kent Hughes said, his entire earthly life was the very embodiment of trust in God. He perfected living by faith. He lived in total dependence on his Father. It was his absolute faith in God that enabled him to go through the mocking, crucifixion, rejection, and desertion, and left him perfect in faith. The sublime fact is he endured everything by faith, and thus he is uniquely qualified to be the author of the faith of his followers. The word used here for the author is archegos, and it's used of Jesus in other places. He's the archegos of life, the author of life. Earlier in Hebrews, he's the archegos of salvation, the author of salvation. Very closely overlapping here, isn't it? The term is found in classical Greek for the founder of a city, for a chieftain, for the first cause or originator of something. Jesus is the founder of the city with foundations. He is our chief, our captain, our king. He is God. He's the first cause of all things, the creator of heaven and earth. But you know what? He's also the perfect man who perfectly carried out faith. And thus he is qualified to be its founder, not just as God, but as man. But not only its founder, its perfecter as well. He's the author and the finisher, the founder and perfecter. Jesus' embodiment of life was perfect, so he can be the perfecter of our faith. Do you see that his perfect faith qualifies him to make your faith perfect too? And that happens in a couple of ways. First, the faith that he gives to believers is perfect in quality. The faith that he gives to you is perfect in quality. Do you understand that about your faith? That is, it is real, your faith. It is true. It is good. It is beautiful because it comes from Jesus Christ. Now, yeah, we have doubts. But you know what? The doubt is not faith. We sin, but the sin is not faith. Sure, some have larger measures of faith, but all faith is of the same substance. One drop of pure faith is of the same essence as an entire ocean of it. It all comes from Christ. It is perfect, and he considers it as such, which is why he accepts it, because he gave it to you. Second, the weak faith that we have begins by his grace to weed out sin in our lives, and the faith grows. This is why we can obey verse 1. This is why we can look to Jesus. These actions bring our faith to completion. Faith is complete when it gets to the end, when it sees with its eyes what is now unseen, when it hopes, what it hopes for is realized. The good news again is that Jesus does this for us. He perfects our faith because he's God and he has the power to do that. And because he is man, and had perfect faith. Now, how was his faith brought to completion? Or to put it in the language of Hebrews, how was he made perfect? Remember earlier in the book it said that Jesus has been made perfect. How? Verse 2. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame. The absolutely critical point here is to see the connection of this language back to the hall of faith in the previous chapter. Jesus' suffering, his enduring, his despising, it's the climax of everyone else's faith in chapter 11. He's the last in the chain, even though we miss it because we have chapter breaks. We think, well, it's chapter 12, it's starting all over something brand new. No. Moses considered the reproaches of Christ better than the treasures of Egypt. Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. We're to look to the cross of Jesus when we consider our faith. Notice he's called Jesus because it's talking about his humanity. It's talking about what he endured like us. He's the ultimate witness in the clouds because you know what? He's the cloud rider himself. He went up into the clouds at his ascension. It's what he promised in right before he died. It's what Daniel predicted in Daniel 7. His ascension is his victory over sin and death and the devil. And he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So he brings the ascension into it here at the end of the verse. That's a major theme that he's been talking about through all of Hebrews. So he's just reminding you what you already know. Heaven was his prize. Life itself. Heaven for us is also what we're looking for. Victory Jesus gained is victory for us. Kingship is what Jesus had. Ruling with him is for us. In trial and temptation, you're not to look to yourself, You have to look to Jesus, who despised sin, endured death, didn't care about the shame, even though he was God, and was made victorious over heaven and earth. He has the power to bring you out of your despair, out of your misery, out of your constantly thinking about all the things you do wrong. He is God, and it is his Father's pleasure by the Spirit to perfect your faith when you look to Christ. And last but not least, we are to reflect on these things. Verse 3, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself. Consider him. We reflect on Christ and the things we've discussed. Reflecting on Christ is the antidote to the poison of sin. It is his parched thirst that becomes our refreshing joy. He was on the cross and he couldn't even swallow. He's so thirsty. Because he did that, we can have joy, water that's eternal for our souls. His weariness to death is our victory over faint-heartedness. We all grow tired. We all grow weary. We all have very serious times of testing and trial and temptation in our faith. We have these ideas and thoughts in our mind to just give it up, to throw it all away. Do not let your hearts be troubled, whispers Lady Wisdom in your ear. Go now and rest, for you are weary with sorrow and much toil. Jesus said, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. I am gentle, I am lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. We have a great cloud of witnesses testifying that these things are true. They are testifying. They aren't just cheering you. They're telling you that they did the same things. Let them embolden you in a much greater way than Peter Forsberg spurred me on. Throw down your sin. Rid yourself of it. Persevere to the end. Don't give up. Don't stop the race. Don't stop coming to church. Don't stop looking to Jesus. Endure. Run your race. Struggle through it. Let this be your act of worship every day. Regard Jesus' sufferings and his death and his victorious life and his ruling ascension. Reflect on the gospel because it is life. And you will make it to the end. This is God's promise for you in Jesus Christ. Lord, if there are people here who are weary and tired of their sin, I pray that you would give them comfort in the gospel. We all have our besetting sin. Help us to know what those are, but help us to turn to Christ. Help us to look to Jesus. Help us to look to what he did for us. Help us to see that the saints of old testify to where their faith was placed. Help us to know that they finished their race, that we can finish the same race. Their trials were much worse than ours. And they made it to the end because Jesus was the perfecter and the finisher and the author of their faith, too. They speak loudly to us, Lord, this great cloud. And Jesus, who is high over the clouds as King of all the earth, speaks to us because he's man and he's endured to the end. But he's been raised from the dead. He's alive. And we celebrate him and worship him. And we thank you that when we hear the things in Hebrews 12, 1 through 3, that we can do them because Christ is pleased to do them in us. It's not us bringing ourselves to it. It's us by faith looking to him who is the author and perfecter of our faith. Thank you for this, Lord. Please encourage us by these words. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.